All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Once again, got completely invigorated. It's like somebody took my hand and put it in the socket over here. And, of course, if I didn't have a shaved head, all my hair would be standing up. Okay. Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm very excited about doing the show this week, as I always am, but this is actually pretty special, I think. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Oregon and what's its connections with all these militias and what's their program and all the, from the Posse Comitatus to who knows what. We're going to dig into that and just find out what the hell is going on up there and why you should be concerned about it, okay? Before that, we'll be talking with Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait and Andy Worthington from basically, Andy Worthington has been working on getting Guantanamo shut down for almost from the very beginning, all right? And we're going to be talking with them about the 14th anniversary of the U.S. torture camp at Guantanamo and what they're doing. They're actually on I think Andy's doing a tour around the country right now, a small tour, but we'll be talking about where things are at, where they stand, and where things are going, and opening the show up. I'm really pleased. I have to say, I'm really pleased to be talking with my guest that's opening the show up because I have read some of the stuff that she's said. I've looked at what her law firm is doing, and I've been paying a lot of attention to guess what, okay? Guess what? To that huge gas leak out at Porter Ranch, all right? And we're going to be talking with Robin Greenwald, environmental and consumer class action attorney at the law firm of Weitz and Luxembourg. That firm is representing some of the residents of Porter Ranch. So let's just jump right into it. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
So you're in France, huh?
I am.
Come on.
I'm meeting with experts here. It's not even a vacation, but
okay, that's good. No, I'm not.
People have been very welcoming.
Yeah, no, you didn't have to explain you were meeting with experts. I'm just amazed at how good you sound. Okay.
Oh, right. I know.
Yeah. It's really amazing. Did you hear the news this morning about Porter Ranch?
Well, which part? That some of the effort to stop the leak may actually have made some of the emissions worse. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, they're saying blowout fears rise with weakened wellhead. And apparently there's been a whole hidden side of what's going on here. Let's talk about that. What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, one of the things about this litigation and about what's happening there is there's new news every day about what's happening there. And so, I mean, I know what's in the paper. I know that from even the BP oil spill litigation that sometimes efforts to stop an uncontrolled leak can make matters worse. So I'm not surprised to hear that happening. I'm sad to hear it happening for the people of the communities that are being impacted. But I think, again, once we can get into litigation and discovery and find out more about what's actually happening on the ground day to day, we'll get so many more answers.
You know, one of the things that, and you know, just I know this is brand news, so I'm not going to continue
it
to
is.
Push on it, but it's really, it's astounding. I mean, I'm looking at the front page of the California section on the LA Times, and one of the things that they keep talking about is that there's actually, I didn't realize they had a no-fly zone over where the pipeline was, and this helicopter pilot decided, hey, to hell with that, and he flew in, and he took a picture. And what it revealed was there's this huge hole around the pipe and that it's really weak. It's like when I was a kid and tried to shore up, it's, you know, something that I thought, okay, this will hold it. And I kept thinking, but they're playing with people's lives. This is the thing that really gets me is that there's been so much.
Some of these wells are more than 70 years old. They're old. And some of them, we don't even know how old they are because the permits don't have a completion date on them, so we don't even know how old they are. But this is an old well field. Yeah, that no-fly zone came into effect a while ago. I want to say it was more than a month ago, maybe 6 weeks. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was early on in the information about the leak. So there's a lot happening, and I think there's another report today that the methane emissions coming out of the hole are much higher than has been reported. We ourselves have done quite a bit of data gathering, and we're just finalizing a lot of it in the next week or so, but we also have seen our findings are that the emissions are considerably higher, 2 to 3 magnitude higher than what's being reported at certain times from the hole. So I think that there's a lot we're all going to learn over the course of the next months.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that comes up with that too, with the methane thing, just so people know, methane is actually one of the worst gases you can get in relation to the climate, the global warming and the rest of this, right?
Right. It's definitely, methane definitely has an impact on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. I mean, again, this is you've seen some of the statistics on what they say about the what this gas leak has meant to the, just basically California's emissions to climate change just since October when the data has come forward. And who knows how long this leak might have been going on before October 23rd. It's another thing we need to find out. Certainly talking to clients, reading what we've read so far, I think a lot of us are of the belief that this leak didn't start on October 23rd. That's when it was disclosed. But I think we'll find again that this leak probably was occurring substantially before. I can't define substantially yet, but certainly many people in certain of the communities were experiencing some of these health impacts before, well before October 23rd.
You know, one of the things that I keep thinking about too is that, and I know this is something that you guys have been talking about in relation to the lawsuit you're filing and stuff, that there's this safety valve. Let's talk a little bit about the safety valve, because that was a stunner. I mean, even without getting into any of the technical stuff, these are people that just decided, well, you know, it's not working. Forget about it. Let's just move on, you know? It blew my mind that they sort of said, we don't need it.
Right, and since I'm not required to have it, I'm not going to replace it. It was on there, but what I love about that is it was on there at one time. So even if it wasn't required, the gas company at one point decided to put it on there. And then when it was, I guess, malfunctioning or broken or whatever, they take it off and then not put it back on. And their stated reason so far for not putting it back on is the law didn't require me to do it. But the law wouldn't have required them to do it earlier than that either. So query, why would you have it on, then not have it on and not replace it? Again, all the kind of things we are looking forward to finding answers to. Mm-hmm. The community really wants those answers. That shutoff valve, I don't know that it would have stopped the leak entirely, but it certainly would have made it less intense and slowed it down.
Yeah, and it would have been nice to know that it was even considered, you know, we'll do this because there may be a problem in the future. We'll keep this here.
You know, right. It has incredible similarities to the BP oil spill, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
If one wants to dust off the cobwebs of the BP oil spill back from, it was April 20th of 2010, it was the same thing with the blowout preventer. They hadn't maintained parts of the blowout preventer. And if they had, they probably could have closed it in and there would have been no oil spill. Mm-hmm. And no one would have died. So it has those same kind of similarities, just not taking just minimal precautions, particularly with a community right on the backside of this well field. And a large community. Everyone talks about Porter Ranch, but it's not just Porter Ranch. It's Chatsworth, it's Northridge, it's Granada Hills. I mean, they're all right on the backside of this well field. And they're all feeling the impacts.
Now, your law firm, and you in particular, have been working with Aaron Brockovich as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And she described this as the country's worst environmental disaster since the BP oil spill in 2010. That's a pretty significant thing when you think about it.
I think that's right. But think about look at the relocation so far. I mean, I think the numbers, I haven't seen numbers in the last few days, but I think as of last week, it was over 3,000 people have been relocated and 3,000 families, excuse me, I should make that clearer, 3,000 households. And there's another 2,000 or 3,000 as of just a few weeks ago seeking relocation. I mean, that's pretty incredible. 6,000 households being relocated. I think that really defines in so many ways the gravity of the situation. People don't get relocated if it's not a grave situation. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah,
there'd
exactly.
be no reason to relocate people.
Right, exactly. And usually, actually, even when it is a grave situation, usually it's sort of like, we'll go along and pretend it's not happening until we get caught, you know? I had interviewed people during the BP oil spill, people who actually were getting extremely sick and were told that, don't worry, it's nothing, nothing's impacting you. And it turns out all the oil and all, what's happening with the seafood and everything else was poisoning people, you know?
It's like 9/11 too, right? When all those towers went down and they told all the first responders, don't worry, the air is okay, you're going to be okay. And of course, we all know now that first responders suffered horrible health impacts. Now, a lot of them have died.
Right.
Again, I'm not saying that's going to happen to the people because of the gas leak. I'm not suggesting that similarity, but I'm suggesting that frequently the health impacts and the economic impacts are whitewashed.
Well, and it gives you a sense of the immorality or amorality of the kind of society that would sort of like allow this kind of thing to flourish. I mean, because I bet you anything that this particular company is not the only one. It's like, you know, negligent around things like, let's make sure that the pipes aren't going to leak or let's keep the safety valves in. It's sort of or hide the things that they do. There's a certain morality that's sort of like, if you can't catch us, we're not going to give it to you, you know?
Right. I know. And one of the requests in our complaints one of the requests for relief, is what we call it, is that the gas company has to determine the root cause of this leak and do an evaluation of all the other wells it has and make sure they're safe, that they're not at risk of the same event, and come up with an emergency response plan so that if heaven forbid another one of these happens, they know what to do right away. They have an emergency response plan that kicks into effect, and you don't have what I would call chaos, which has certainly defined what's been going on since October 23rd. I don't know what happened before then because it wasn't public, but there's certainly been chaos. I mean, people who have tried to get relocated have had innumerable problems. I won't go over them on the phone because your radio show will go too long. People's reimbursement, just simple things like that. Mm-hmm. Having a plan in place of how to plug the hole, I mean, these are the kind of things that you shouldn't be studying after it happens. When you have a well field of this size, this age, in a residential community, you need to have all those things in place before anything happens, not after it happens, trying to figure out how to connect the dots. That doesn't make any sense, not to me anyway. Now, and clearly not to you, I can tell from listening to you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's enraging, actually, when you think about all this stuff. It's sort of, and one of the things I was going to say, well, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Robin Greenwald, environmental and consumer class action attorney at the law firm of Weitz & Luxembourg, and she is representing some of the residents of Porter Ranch, where the gas leak has been just ravaging that part of the planet, and who knows where else it's going. I mean, when they're talking about the possibility in the news today, when they're talking about the possibility of this could erupt as a much bigger thing, I mean, they're actually positing it. And you know, when they start talking about it, when the company itself starts talking about it as, well, it could get really bigger, nobody knows where this is going to go. And that takes me to this. You were talking about something I read earlier. You were talking about yourself, about what actually the visceral impact of this. I want people to get a sense of the visceral impact of this. The fact that you spoke with and you met from the very beginning and heard the stories of the people who lived there and what's happening to them, what has happened to them. It's not just like they got a headache and said, oh, you know, I don't know what to do. People got very, very sick.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was trying to describe actually to some of my colleagues who haven't had a chance yet to go out and meet the community. I said, imagine your life is just totally normal. You're going along. And one day, everything turns upside down. You find out that your children are going to a school that's making them sick. They're coming home with nosebleeds. They're throwing up. They're having horrible headaches. They can't sleep because they're feeling so sick. And it's sort of towards the end of the semester. And so if your children are in middle school or high school, the whole exam time and college applications, if you have little kids, you think, oh, my goodness, their bodies are so tiny. Am I irresponsible for staying here? But it's the end of the year. What do I do? You have a home. Suddenly, you need to move. You need to get out of your home. It's holiday time. And then you think, was I irresponsible for staying? Then you try to get a relocation, and you get a runaround, and you're not told you can move. Or you were moved early on, family of four, family of five, to a one-room hotel room. One room. Think about that. Three kids, mother and father. And so those things, and they're happening in real time, and you don't really understand, and no one's informing you actually what you're breathing. I mean, there's much more in the public domain today than there was in middle November when this really became front page news, at least locally it did. And so all those things are going around in your head, and it's just like, is this really happening to me? There's almost that sense initially of disbelief, like I must be making this up, or I must be exaggerating it. It can't really be happening. And then the reality sinks in. And then the practical aspects of how do I make this happen? How do I put all the pieces together and get us out of here? And then, of course, early on, it was like, this isn't really going to hurt you anyway. And then you think, well, maybe I shouldn't move. But then you're getting the other fact, well, this could have long-term impacts, so I better move. And it's that uncertainty of what to do today, tomorrow, and the next day that really does play havoc on your mind, on your life, on your children. People's pets got really, really sick because they tend to be outdoors. You have a wonderful climate in California. So you leave your dogs outside, right? Of course, they're happier outside. But they're breathing the gas then all day, every day. You have increased bills. You have your children are going to the doctor more. You take your pets to the vet. You don't get a copay at a vet. You know, I mean, I could go on. And then some people work out of their homes in this area. There are people in all those communities I mentioned, Chatsworth, Granada Hills, Porter Ranch, Northridge. Some of them work at home. So now they get sick when they're working at home. So now they've also lost their place of business. They've lost their income. I mean, the list goes on. It's really quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. People are worried about their elderly parents who might be living with them or visiting them. It was holiday time, so some families were coming to visit. I mean, again, I could go on and on, but I don't want to take up too much time. But it is really, it's chilling to listen to people's stories. And then you think, wow, if that were me, how would I handle it? And I would be a wreck. It's very stressful, extraordinarily stressful.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things too, and just thinking about that, one of the things that's been happening is that the smell, there's what actually is happening to people just through the leak. But then there's also the smell itself, that people, there's been reports that actually this is, people are saying, look, this is what's making us really, this is making us really sick. And a lot of officials are saying, and company officials are saying, well, yeah, this is what's making them sick, but it's nothing to worry about. And yet there's actually those, what are they, mercaptans. Yeah. And that they're saying, don't worry about it. It's nothing to worry about. But then there's, you know, you're sitting there, you're looking at, yeah, you're the same people decided not to put the safety valve because it would just be too expensive and too much work. We're not going to do it. And the fact that they put. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, you go.
Well, I was just going to say, and the fact that they put their profitability and their ability to just keep churning things out without care to what happens to the community, to the atmosphere, to anything, and even deciding at one point to say, well, we know we could replace these things, but, you know, we're not really going to do this. And all of this is sort of, it's not only horrific, it's enraging, because then you look at what's happening, and now they're telling people, don't worry about these additives that are there, that are actually there to give the smell. It's not going to hurt you, you know, and I think there's something really weird going on with that.
Well, and honestly, a simple Google search on health impacts of mercaptan actually will identify all the symptoms that people in the community are experiencing. Hmm. I mean, so for the gas company to say there's no reaction to this, it's just, I mean, literally, they could go to Google and they could go to dozens of very well-recognized websites that sort of explain what I'll call acute or immediate reactions to things like mercaptans and methane gas. And they are exactly what this community is experiencing and continue to experience. And so I don't know if you've been there, but I have. And I have a pretty high tolerance. I've been there with other people who have different tolerances. And we all, every single person, we don't live there, but even visiting for a few hours, we all leave with something, either a scratchy throat, congestion, bad headaches. It depends who it is. Everyone has a different reaction because humans, of course, are unique and every person will react to a chemical in a different way or could. But there's still like a suite of reactions, but not everyone will have everything within the suite of reactions. But even a three-hour visit there, a two-hour visit on some days will make you feel bad. Mm. Again, what that bad is going to be defined a little differently on who you are. But I have never been there where I haven't left with at least something. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty remarkable. So think about if you live there 24/7.
Yeah. And I'm just reading something that says that the tests that were conducted in November by the California Air Resources Board, the leak is spewing 50,000 kilograms of gas per hour. And that's the equivalent of to the strength of a volcanic eruption. So you imagine how much of that is coming out, you know, 24/7 all the way through, you know, it's sort of,
Right. Boy. And our data that we have been looking at shows that's higher than that. But that number's too low. Mm-hmm. But it's a higher emission than they reported back in November.
Yeah, oh boy. You know, one of the things.
Worse than that.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you one more thing. Two more things. Is it true that the originally, and I don't know if it's still true, when they were offering shelter for people, one, that as you were saying, all the various problems people have getting that, but also, was it really only for 3 months?
Yes.
Is that still standing?
It's still only for 3 months.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, presumably, I'm going to assume that if in 3 months people are relocated still and the gas leak hasn't been stopped, I would hope that they would extend that. But right now, it is a firm 3 months. And just to complicate matters even worse, the relocation document they have to sign when you relocate, so if you're a resident of one of these communities and you get relocation, you have to sign a document that basically says you have to notify the landlord, the entity that's it's not really a landlord, it's a relocation company. You have to notify them 30 days before your lease term is up, so that would be after 60 days, that you're going to vacate in 30 days. Or if you don't do that, then you're going to be responsible for yet another month. So if you think about this, I know that's probably way too complicated, but so the gas companies agreed to 3 months. So you know you're covered for 3 months by the gas company. But now you're at say, February 1st, and so February is the end of your third month, you don't know if the gas leak's going to be stopped by February 23rd, right? You don't have any idea.
Mm-hmm.
The gas company says that's the goal, you know, the end of February, early the 1st of March, but no one knows if that's really going to work. So now, on February 1st, technically, under that relocation agreement, you have to notify the relocation company that you are going to cease your relocation at the end of the 30-day period. And if you don't, you are going to be obligated for that fourth month.
Hello, Robin? All right, I think we just lost the connection with Robin. She's in France, so it was hard to get hold of her. Anyway, if she can't hear us, but it was a pleasure talking with you, Robin. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Robin Greenwald, environmental and consumer class action attorney at the law firm of Weitz & Luxembourg, and we've been talking about that horrendous methane spill leak at the Porter Ranch, at that whole setup out there, and the thing that basically, it's a living illustration of capitalism putting profits before people, all right? And that's, they don't care. They don't give a damn about people. What they give a damn about is actually their profits. And that's what's really revealed in this whole Porter Ranch natural gas leak, all right? You know, they're saying natural gas, and I'm tempted to say natural. Yeah, natural, but also it's natural gas, but the gas is leaking because of everything that the gas company and the money behind it did to sort of squeeze out all the profit, as much profit as they could, and to hell with the people. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Deborah Sweet and Andy Worthington about Guantanamo, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That's David Bowie. And boy, is he going to be missed. And that's I'm Afraid of Americans, Volume 1. All right. It's a great song, as were many of his songs, most of his songs. I really liked them. And it was sad to see him die. Anyway, right now, this month marks the 14th anniversary of the U.S. torture chamber at Guantanamo. And joining us to talk about where things stand and what needs to be done, what has to be done, what people should be doing around this, is Deborah Sweet, director of The World Can't Wait, and Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files and co-founder of We Stand With Shocker. Deborah, Andy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how you doing, man?
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Deborah.
Well, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm in New York City. I've been having a very busy and interesting time meeting all kinds of people and trying to get the word out.
Good. Well, let's talk about what's the word that you're trying to get out.
That Guantanamo must be closed, and, you know, must be closed before President Obama leaves office. The good thing about that is that he also knows that. Whether he fulfills it or not is a different matter. But he knows that because he came into office 7 long years ago, promising to close it within a year. So that's rather embarrassing. And he's aware that, you know, that his legacy is being written and that it won't be a footnote at the back of the history of presidency of Barack Obama. It'll be really quite prominent there that he made this promise and then didn't keep it if he doesn't get it closed within the next year. So hopefully that really is going to mean something, Michael. And we're certainly seeing movement on the closure of Guantanamo. A lot of prisoners being released now. Promised yesterday from the State Department that the rest of the men currently approved for release, which is 34 of the remaining 93 prisoners, will be out by summer. And then we're down to 59 people, and only 10 of those are facing trials or have faced trials. The rest of them are euphemistically described as too dangerous to release by the administration, by the task force that reviewed the cases of all the prisoners back in 2009. How can somebody who's held without charge or trial and has been for all this time be regarded as too dangerous to release? And the excuse that the administration has is that they're regarded as that, but there's insufficient evidence to put them on trial. So the whole thing is a farce because there is no evidence. What there is a collection of hearsay and innuendo, stories made up by their fellow prisoners under the use of torture or abuse or being bribed with better living conditions, which, you know, the task force thought, maybe there's something in this, maybe this is worrying, and therefore we shouldn't let them out. Maybe these guys, you know, also some of them have threatened their captors over the years, as I'm sure you and I and your listeners can think. Maybe you would lash out at the people who were imprisoning you and treating you so horribly over all this time. But if you make a threat against the guard force, that goes down in your file and marks you out as somebody who is too dangerous to release. So there's a review process underway, Michael, where these men are having their cases reviewed to find out whether they still are too dangerous to release. The good news is, for 2 years, there have been 18 cases, and in 15 of them, so 83% of them, too dangerous to release turns out to be, no, actually, we can release these guys. That's very good. But there are over 40 men still waiting to have their cases reviewed. And at the current rate, they won't be completed until long after President Obama leaves office. So he really, really needs to speed up this process if he's going to have a chance of closing Guantanamo and doing what he needs, which is to bring the men facing trials to the U.S. mainland and, honestly, to bring as small a number as possible of other prisoners that he doesn't intend to put on trial. And I say as small as possible because when he brings guys to the U.S. mainland and tries to hold them without charge or trial, he's going to be up against the U.S. Constitution. And I really do think these men will have the opportunity to challenge the basis of their detention quite thoroughly.
All right, Andy, I want to warn you, do not put a lot of faith in the Constitution, okay? let's just be real about that, brother. Deborah, let me ask you this. Why? You posed a question. World Can't Wait has posed two questions, and I wanted to ask you that. Why do you think Guantanamo is still open, and what can be done to close it?
Well, I would say the demand is close Guantanamo now. And as to the point of the prisoners who are termed too dangerous to release, it really may be a situation where they're too dangerous for the U.S. government to try, especially in open court if they had their rights of due process, because the torture might come out. The fact that they're too dangerous to try is probably related to the fact that they were tortured, and they were certainly in the world's most notorious torture camp, and I think that's why Guantanamo is still open. There are forces in the U.S. government who openly argue, cut the head off ISIS. That's Trump, but there are forces now in the U.S. government who's saying we need a place where people can be put away forever, where there's no recourse to getting out, and I think that's situated in the larger context of the U.S. war on terror. Indeed, indefinite detention and torture, targeted assassination, and the killing of 1.3 million people in the Middle East is part of the U.S.'s war on terror on the world. Mm-hmm. That's why they need to keep it open. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's not, it is illegitimate, it's unjust, it's immoral, and a lot more people need to be raising their voices against what is happening.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that came out too, and I think this really struck me around Shakar Amer. I interviewed Mozambique shortly after he got out of Guantanamo way back, you know, and
yeah,
it was very heavy what he was saying then. And you know, it was, we spent an hour with him, and it was just sort of very, very heavy understanding what was going on. And it was also, as I was listening to him, I was very struck by the fact that he was saying a lot of stuff that I'm certain that the U.S. Imperials didn't appreciate being out there on one level, although it was also, well, we can scare the hell out of some people, but it was really, it was an exposure of the character, the actual nature of the system. I think in terms of like what Deborah was saying, it's like, it's very important. And I read, Andy, I read the interview with Shakar Amer, can't remember where I found it, but it was very interesting to listen to the stories that he told about the treatment he received in Guantanamo. You know, Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think he's been, in his interviews, he's been calling it a place designed to destroy human beings. And, you know, that's certainly what it is. There are elements of Guantanamo which have involved human experimentation, psychological experimentation, pharmacological experimentation. Some of this we can see, you know, there's a long history of the United States doing this. Let's look back to what the CIA has been doing for decades. Part of Guantanamo is, you know, Guantanamo is part of a continuum in some ways, in, you know, experimentation, which we can see elements of that going back to the Nazis. You know, what it also is a place where, as Deborah mentioned, and as I'm concerned to stress this, it's a place where there are certain dark forces within the United States who want a prison where they can practice indefinite detention without charge or trial, where they can hold you without due process, where they can say to the American people, these are the really bad guys, don't worry about it. What we're doing is for your own good. Go back to sleep, sleep soundly. Don't ask questions about who these people are or what we're doing. And it's part of an arsenal of you know, current warfare as practiced by the United States, which involves drone killings and all the other things that are going on. So I can see that that's a key element that they want to keep going, which is really why we all need to work so hard to remove this particular element of it. It isn't going to mean that other things go away, but it's going to remove one key element, because a turn to the right from where we are is definitely going to mean that more people arrive at Guantanamo. One of the things that President Obama hasn't done is to move people into Guantanamo. Every time that the Republicans see an opportunity when a terrorist suspect is captured somewhere and then is brought to the United States to stand trial, there are always these calls to put them in Guantanamo. And, that's what we have to stop. We need to stop this one element of it from being possible. So, you know, there isn't a single good thing to be said about Guantanamo from a human and decent and legal point of view about what it does. You know, it's designed to destroy people. It's designed to destroy the law domestically, internationally, all the treaties that the U.S. has signed. It's designed to destroy habeas corpus. It's designed to destroy the Geneva Conventions, which is, you know, why I've been on the case for so long, Michael, and why, you know, I'm really having a push this last year to try and bring some of the tactics that we used with the successful We Stand With Shaka campaign to get Shaka Armour, the last British resident, out of Guantanamo, which is to try and this year attract celebrity support and the support of ordinary people. And what I'll be launching very soon through the Close Guantanamo website, closeguantanamo.org, which I co-founded 4 years ago, is for people to print off a poster pointing out how long it is until the end of President Obama's presidency. We'll be counting down. We'll have posters every 50 days and encouraging people to take photos of themselves, to send a photo in, to send a message in. And we're working on attracting celebrity support for this, as well as inviting members of the public who are concerned to do so. And just trying to keep the pressure on this year, really.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, well, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking right now with Deborah Sweet, the director of World Can't Wait, and Andy Worthington, author of The Guantanamo Files and co-founder of We Stand With Shocker. And we're talking about the fight to close Guantanamo now and a lot of other related things, including that there was originally the demand to release Shocker Armour, and he's been released, and it's a very important thing. And one of the things that actually has come out in relation to these recent developments, which I found very, very, you know, heavy. And I wanted to ask you about this, Deborah, the impact in terms of what you were talking about why, you know, what does the U.S., why the U.S. has this thing, the need. I mean, they are going all over the world. They're reaching out. They're pounding the rest of the world. There's this whole effort. They're going to get into it full and deep. And here's the thing where you have Guantanamo, you know, and then you had Abu Ghraib, you know, and you look at these, and Abu Ghraib was, I mean, that was like a, when that was exposed, that was like taking a pencil and shoving it in the eye of the imperialists. And it really was sort of like a big exposure. And then they came back with just all kinds of justifications of the kind of torture that existed there. And right now you have a very similar thing when you're talking about Guantanamo. And you have recently, there was a video of the forced feeding that came out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the government doesn't want that coming out. The regime doesn't want that coming out. And there's a fight to actually to get that out there so people can see it's not sort of something that people just thought would be catchy to say, this is a torture chamber.
Yeah, well, you know, you're making a direct connection because the techniques developed for Guantanamo overnight in 2002 were exported to Abu Ghraib, for instance, and to military prisons in Iraq, for instance. And after all, they tortured people in Afghanistan before they even took them to Guantanamo, sent them around the world to dark sites. And the Obama administration, however much Obama may want to close Guantanamo for different reasons, every single gets into court. The Obama administration argues and fights to keep any of this evidence being released, including the forced feeding, including the stories of torture. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot at stake here. And what is it? Here you have a world polarized right now in a way since 9/11 between the outmoded strata, the ruling strata of the imperialist countries, mainly the U.S. leading this whole war on terror, and the outmoded strata of oppressed humanity, the Islamic jihadists. It's developed that way because of the collapse, for the most part, of the communist movement in the world. You know, I draw this analysis from Babakian, and I think it is really true. We need to step back and look at this context and understand that within all of that, of course, it's on us to bring forward another way. Neither of these outmoded forces have any legitimacy to run society. And yet most of the world is seeing a great division between these outmoded forces. And ironically, and this is important around what Avakian says, really, that if you support one, you reinforce both. This whole war on terror. You know, you look at Guantanamo and you see the U.S. practicing torture, indefinite detention, and really going out to dehumanize people, as Shocker said. And it is creating enemies. I firmly believe that that's very likely true. It's an exposure of the U.S. supposedly standing for freedom and democracy. And then on the other side, people are not fighting back in a way they need to fight back, which is to stand for a whole new society and getting away from the commodification of human beings, the torture, the war, and all of what imperialism has come to represent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people do have to struggle to understand what's behind this. I would commend everybody to go to a very important article by Avakian that you can see on revcom.us, Bringing Forward Another Way, where he goes into this process of understanding what's happening, what are the forces underlying this war on terror, and then a lot about understanding these contradictions, and then what are we going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
A big part of it really is resistance on the basis of bringing forward another way.
Mm-hmm. All right, Deborah, Andy, we really got to wrap up. I'm just running over time, but it was really interesting, really important to talk with you. And hopefully the next time that the three of us talk, we're talking about, damn, that was good getting Guantanamo closed and getting all them people out of there. All right, so take care and keep doing it, all right?
All right.
Everyone should go look at Andy's coverage on closeguantanamo.org.
What is the site again?
Closeguantanamo.org.
Closeguantanamo.org. I knew that.
And also my website, andyworthington.co.uk.
That's it. All right. And Andy, I'll talk to you again soon. Deborah, you too.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Andy Worthington, who is the author of Guantanamo Files and the co-founder of We Stand With Shocker. And we've also been talking with Deborah Sweet, director of The World Can't Wait. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Ryan Lenz to talk about what the hell is going on in Oregon. I didn't want to let that one stop, all right? That's Ted Sirota's Rebel Souls, and it's from his album Seize the Time, and it's a cover of Free Cell Block F, Tis Nazi USA, which is Mingus's big piece, all right? And I just thought that was kind of appropriate for what we're just about to talk to now. All right, if you've been paying attention at all in the world, you've seen recently what went on in Oregon, where all of a sudden this motley crew of, yes, once again, the Bundys are out there, and a whole lot of other people have flocked to it. A crew of people who have taken over a federal building in a wilderness area, and they're basically, they're holed up there, and they have a whole political program that they are slowly enunciating, but that are actually pointing out, and that I think, actually, and what I've been reading and looking at, it's actually a very dangerous program and something that should not and cannot be ignored by people who care about the fate of humanity and what's going on and how the world is now and what it needs to be. Joining us to talk about all this is Ryan Lenz. And Ryan is from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he's a contributor to their Hate Watch blog. And we're going to be talking with Ryan about what the hell is going on and who are all these white supremacists. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it, man. Who the hell are these people and what's going on?
Well, I'm going to correct you a little bit. They're not white supremacists, but they are extremists. They're largely anti-government extremists driven by all ideologies that are largely infused with conspiracy theories and a large feeling that the federal government is tyrannical. The occupation of that building started shortly after a protest in Oregon, and it was led by none other than Amon Bundy and Ryan Bundy, who are the sons of Cliven Bundy, who your listeners might remember was central to an armed standoff a couple of years ago in Bunkerville, Nevada. So that's the core of who's there. And it has since, in the weeks that this occupation has been allowed to go on, it has since become sort of the cause celeb of militiamen, ranchers, all of whom have, to at least some degree, pretty firm backing of conspiracy theories to justify what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me this, just on this question of what's happening there. I mean, Cliven Bundy, when that happened, I mean, a whole hell of a lot of the people that came there, it's true that there were all these people who came from these militias and whatnot. But there was also that statement that he made about black people, and this is what, you know, it was like something
right.
that was really, I mean, I would feel pretty safe saying white supremacists, you know? I mean, it's sort of...
For Cliven?
Yeah.
that statement that you're referencing was came out of nowhere. No one saw that coming. But you're right, though. You know, this anti-government ideology that's driving this movement, its origins are with the Posse Comitatus, which had some pretty racist core beliefs, namely that Jewish bankers were controlling the money and keeping, you know, good, God-fearing white men, you know, in states of slavery or servitude. But in the years that have passed since, you know, the 30 years or so that ideology has morphed and changed and evolved, there's been a distinct separation from its racist roots. So now many people who hold that ideology don't recognize that it once began as a very racist belief system, and now and hold it to be, you know, sort of a representative, a love of liberty or a love of American freedom and so on, totally ignoring its racist origins.
Mm-hmm.
So while these militia members and the Bundys are holed up in Oregon under the credo or the claim that they're supporting a true constitutional republic and, for that matter, liberty writ large, they're sort of completely oblivious to the ideology's origins.
Well, let's talk about the Posse Comitatus a little bit, because, you know, if you put the Bundys in the context of the whole history of this sort of populist, whatever, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, but, it's this very reactionary movement that's out there in society, and has been. And there's a chain that runs along from way back. I know you guys and I think you were involved in putting this together, did this sort of a timeline or sort of an explanation of where all these pieces come together, how they flow from
right.
one another. And actually the Posse Comitatus seemed to have a big impact on what flowered after that in terms of these kinds of militia groups and these kinds of,
absolutely.
You know, go ahead, talk about that.
Well, you know, the Posse Comitatus was a large movement in which this sort of anti-government ideology ultimately began, and it held that the county sheriff was the highest law enforcement officer in the land, and that any sort of federal law enforcement or state law enforcement was the construct of a manipulation or some sort of crazy change on what the Constitution really intended. It was largely a farm-based movement, and it received widespread populist support during the farm crisis of the 80s, where farmers were they were losing their farms. And so you had a bunch of preachers who would, you know, preachers or gurus who would travel around the Midwest and elsewhere spreading this ideology, saying that really what was happening was that the Jews had co-opted the whole system and were working against your interests, you know, the farmers and so on. Ultimately, that ideology sort of flips and changes, and I guess the metaphor that I've always used is that if you look at anti-government thought, think of it like this. The Posse Comitatus is basically the rock that hits the windshield, right? And there's 1,000 branches that come out from it, you know, which may or may not recognize where they began, but, you know, without a doubt, they're all branches on the same tree. So right now, what we're looking at is that timeline that you're talking about. It was in a report that we produced shortly after the standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014. And what it looked at was sort of how the anti-government movement at large had moved out west and taken or hijacked, really, issues regarding land use and so on to spread their ideology and gather support. Such that by 2014, when Cliven Bundy took on the federal government over $1 million in grazing fees and fines that he had amassed, it was sort of the culminating moment where all sorts of different strains of anti-government thought came together as a unified force to recognizing that that moment was likely the most promising they had to take the federal government on, like, directly. And in the aftermath of that, the federal government made some serious mistakes, because they left. They ceded the argument to Cliven Bundy and his well-armed militia supporters, and they've been suffering, or we've all been seeing, the aftermath of that, which is widespread validity given to that argument. Furthermore, Furthermore, what we've seen is that this idea that the federal government is wrong and that law and order does not apply so long as you have a bigger gun than the person trying to enforce the law has spread across the West. It's been endorsed or embraced by elected officials at state and regional levels, including some congressmen. So it's a troubling moment right now because it's an issue of whether this idea is given the stamp of legitimate approval or whether it's recognized for what it is, which is absolute lawlessness.
You know, it's interesting, too, though. There's a point here, and I can't help but keep going back to this, because there's a point here where there's sort of this back and forth between the militias that sprang up, especially since the 80s or the 90s or something, these, you know, various militias that have sprung up, particularly and mainly among white people. You know, there's the crossover between that and the movements like the Cliven Bundy kind of thing that's developing, even where you have people who are extremists of various sorts on one end of it, well, actually on both ends of it. But you have that, and you're looking at this, and I kept thinking, I remember back in like 79, there was a big farmer movement that came to D.C.,
right,
and they took over Washington, and they camped out there for a long time. And I talked to a lot of those people, you know, and a lot of them were people who were up against it. And they were, you know, in terms of their farm and what was being done, and I can't remember all the details about what happened, but there was a real kind of like, we can't survive anymore, and we're coming here, and we're taking a stand. And at that point, even though there was an element of like a lot of John Birchism in that, you know, that was sure, you know, spreading through that, it wasn't everybody. And there was a lot of struggle. And I remember they put down some guy wrote a book about something about from the farm to the Huskow or something. And it was, you know, there was this whole thing about here was a group of people that sort of weren't used to being treated like this, and they weren't used to standing up. But you could look at that and you could divide it out. Now, when you're looking at these militias and the crossover and the sharing of, you know, you find sometimes the head of a militia is also somebody who's like in the equivalent of the Klan. You know, all these kinds of things that happen, that's a pretty heavy thing. And it's rooted in a whole situation where you have this massive crisis going on in the world and in this country. And these people are making a certain response to this. And to me, that's something that's very, very concerning when you have this kind of fascistic almost response to this kind of thing where you're actually bringing together these people from, what is it, the Promise Keepers or the Oath Keepers or whatever it is. Yeah, and these are all these reactionary groups that really are, you know, when you get right down to examining their program, are fascists.
Well, it's interesting because I think what's happening is sort of, it's definitely predatory. You're right to sort of recognize that the complaints or the issues that are ultimately at the core of all of this, you know, some of them are legitimate. The Hammonds, for example, in Oregon, which started this whole thing, they were at risk of losing their farms and they had serious complaints. But what happens is, in order to make sense of what's happening to them, or like someone who's losing their home or someone who's about to go bankrupt, in order to make sense of what's happening to them, because they don't want to think that it's their fault, and sometimes it might not be, but they start diving into we have the World Wide Web now, where they can look for possible reasons this is happening to them. The World Wide Web is fraught with sort of extremist rabbit holes that you can go down. And all of a sudden, you find that there are answers for why these problems are happening to you. There are answers, and they generally are putting the blame elsewhere, on the Jews or the federal government or immigrants or whatever. And then it becomes a moment where an organized hate group or an organized anti-government group can jump in and say, listen, we have a solution for you. And it's very much a radicalization process and a recruitment process that very much needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's something that's extremely, extremely, you know, look, people should be concerned about this because there is this sort of polarization that is going on right now. And in some ways, you want to see something polarized, but you also want to be able to get in there and have, for me, for a revolutionary solution to all this. And this is what's happening, is that you are getting this very, very right-wing, sometimes fascistic, repressive, all these things that have a program and have ties to the upper levels of the government. I mean, you think about, look at the Republican nominees right now. Boy, I'll tell you, some of these guys are not that much different than Trump and Cruz. Huh?
Well, if I could talk about that for a quick second, it's interesting because one of the arguments that is driving this entire movement out west is this obscure thing called Agenda 21, okay? Agenda 21 was a non-binding compact signed by over 200 countries in the early 90s, saying that these countries would, as they grew at state, local, and national levels, they would consider sustainable growth. They would consider the environment in everything they did, recognizing that we are a world of finite resources, and that, as we've seen with gobs of climate change reporting, we can cause the planet trouble. And so Agenda 21 was this compact that people signed. It was a United Nations thing. And it quickly became recognized as a blueprint on the radical right, as a blueprint for what they called the New World Order, which was ultimately an idea that there was a massive scheme being hatched by globalists and rich billionaires around the world to enslave the human race. And so Agenda 21 is an idea that is central to what's happening out west, because in the Bundy situation, for example, they believed that Agenda 21 was central to why the federal government was coming after them. They thought that species were being categorized as endangered so that farmers and ranchers could be pushed off the land. Now, it's interesting.
Ryan, we got like 5 seconds left. I think that's an important point. People should look. Yeah, and they should. Definitely go to the Southern Poverty Law Center website and look this stuff up. And I know you worked on a whole booklet there that's very, very informative on this. And I just want to remind you of one thing. I think if that was black people, brown people, or Native Americans, they wouldn't have lasted very long taking over any building or any farm or anything else. And that's just a set. I mean, we can deal with the Black Panthers, what happened to them, Wounded Knee, Attica Prison. There's a whole history here, brother. So anyway, I want to thank you very much, Ryan, for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care now. All right, we've got a little bit of time left at the end of this show, so I'd like to play a short statement from Carl Dix, the representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. It's Carl Dix calls on you to stand up for women and call out patriarchal so-called freedom fighters. Now, you may have heard Sansara Taylor last week talking about being in the streets on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade to stand up for the right to abortion. Carl is adding his voice and talking about the revolution and the kind of system we need to emancipate women.
All right, we're dealing with an emergency situation. There's a war being waged on women, and this war is concentrated around taking from women the right to decide to have an abortion. Look, this is a basic right. Abortion is not murder, fetuses are not children, and women are not incubators. There should be no shaming, no guilt involved in a woman exercising this right. Women do not have a duty to society or to a man to bear children, and no government or no church should be able to force women to become mothers. Enforced motherhood is female enslavement. This has got to be fought. It's got to be stopped. And right now, an important part of doing this is joining us in the streets. In Washington, D.C. on January 22nd and in San Francisco on January 23rd, to stand up for abortion rights and to say no to this war on women. And this is not just a fight for women. Men have to be involved in this too. Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has said, you can't break all the chains but one. You can't be about fighting to break those chains that bind you into oppression, but then wanting to keep intact the chains that bind women into subordinate positions in society. You got to be fighting to break all of the chains of oppression. And let me tell you something else about Bob Avakian. He's figured the way to end all of the horrors this system enforces on people here and around the world through revolution. He's developed a vision of the kind of world we could bring into being through revolution. He's developed a strategy for making that revolution and a method and approach for leading the process of building up to that revolution. And everybody who wants to get free, who wants to see all these horrors ended, need to get with the movement for revolution that Bob Avakian is leading, and they need to dig into the work that he's done to develop the approach and understanding of how to make revolution. This is what you got to be about doing. Now look, I know that there's some people who say that, well, black people can't deal with all of that because they got to get the black family back together, and that the key to doing that is to get the black man back into his position as head of the black family. This is really not about liberation, brothers and sisters. I even heard an old fool call for 10,000 warriors who will all be men to come forward and fight for freedom, and then that there should be 10,000 women who would do the cooking, the cleaning, and raising the children for these warriors. In other words, 10,000 domestic slaves. This has nothing to do with liberation. This is slave master talk being brought forward here. People also say, well, the youth need male role models. No, they don't. They need revolutionary role models. Women and men standing together and fighting together against all the hell that this system is bringing down on people. The youth need that, and frankly, the older people need that too, and we all, old and young, need to join in doing just that, fighting against this hell that the system is bringing down and becoming emancipators of humanity, fighting to end every form of exploitation and oppression that people are up against today. Look, that's what's needed, and I want to leave you with two things. The first, get with the movement for revolution and the leader for that movement for revolution by going to the website revcom.us. Two, stand up for abortion rights. Say no to the war on women by being in the streets in Washington, D.C. on January 22nd and San Francisco on January 23rd.
All right, that was Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And now we've come to the end of yet another show. So I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going out now with Black Star from David Bowie's last album.